Welcome to the Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast. Conversations with leaders who made difficult decisions and built lasting legacies. I am Rick Williams. I speak and write about how leaders can be more successful. My best-selling book, Create the Future, is your essential guidebook for making difficult decisions. This podcast is an opportunity for me and for you to hear how leaders with a wide variety of backgrounds have managed the challenges they faced, made difficult decisions, and had courage when going forward is tough. You will learn important lessons from other leaders. You will find that engaging with our 30-minute conversation will be a great investment of your valuable time. So let's get started. Welcome to the Create the Future podcast. I'm Rick Williams. The Create the Future podcast is a forum for leaders to share their stories about making difficult decisions for their company or for any organization, and in some cases for themselves. My goal with this podcast is to share the stories of leadership from leaders who have made difficult choices for their organizations so that you will become a more successful leader of your organization by learning from these stories. We have a great guest today with a compelling story to share, and we will hear what lessons about what worked and didn't work, and I know you're going to learn a lot from this conversation. So I'm excited to introduce you to Dusty Holcomb. Dusty is the CEO of Arcus Group. He works as a coach with senior executives. And Dusty, give us a short introduction of who you are and your story and your life story up to this point.
Rick, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. You know, it's life story. That's a tough one. But, it really starts with the fact that when I was 10 years old, I was given the ultimate dream of every child. I was told that, hey, Dusty, would you like to stop going to school? And, you know, what fifth grader in their right mind is not going to raise their hand, jump up and down and say, yes, please, I don't want to go to school anymore? Well, it happened because we lived in a very rural part of Georgia, and my parents realized that me spending a couple hours each way on the bus wasn't that conducive to learning, and we embraced homeschooling. And that was back in the 80s when homeschooling was not not as popular and not as well structured as it was today. I can look back now and go that decision, you know, me being a 10-year-old kid, it was all about fun, but led to me becoming a very autodidactic, self-taught learner who loved to read. And so my passion for reading and study and the seeds of curiosity about how I could study whatever I wanted. For me, that was military history and biographies of great thinkers and all these things I could learn from other people. That was really formative to the person I would become. You know, I had to overcome being told when I got ready for college that, I was probably pretty dumb and needed to explore other careers. And, I used that as motivation and went back and slid my transcript across the desk to that admissions counselor and said, thank you for the motivation. I graduated summa cum laude. I guess I'm not that dumb. I guess I am cut out for college. And it led to me having the opportunities to, at 21 years old, be put in a leadership role with a couple hundred people reporting to me. And then at 23 years old, to take on a responsibility of moving a call center from a large city to a small town where I would go in and get to hire everyone in that small community. And at 23 years old, I'm not sure, either how desperate or drunk or dumb the people were that were hiring me, because I certainly wasn't qualified, at least through the lens of the way I would look at someone now, certainly. And, it was just such a blessing. But the formation of who I am today and the lessons I've learned and the decisions I've made and the journey I've been on really comes back to this process of understanding that when we learn, we grow, and it is our responsibility to gather information and insights from a variety of places so that we can make better decisions.
Well, Dusty, that's great. Now, before we get into this conversation about decision-making and how you make decision-making and lessons learned from your experiences, I'm actually going to start with a really important question, and that is, where did your name Dusty come from?
My middle name is Dustin, And I have been Dusty since the day I was born, that nickname I was given, except for one brief period in the fourth grade when I didn't want to be different and I wanted to be like everybody else. And there must have been four or five other Johns in the class, which is my first name. And I went by the name of John. So my entire life, I have been Dusty, except for the fourth grade. And, you know, now I look at it as such a gift to have a unique name, a different name. And I believe that names do, you know, become part of our identity and we associate, and my name couldn't fit me better. I'm a cowboy boots and blue jeans kind of guy. And my name certainly merits and warrants that. And the best part about it, maybe as a benefit, is if someone ever calls me and asks to speak to John, I know that they don't know me and they're probably calling for money or I'm in trouble.
Oh my gosh, boy, I can understand that. I have to say, listening to you share your story about Dusty reminds me of my own experience with my own name. So my full name is Richard Williams. My dad's name was Richard Williams. My grandfather's name was Richard Williams. Maybe very unimaginative in the Williamses in the world, but anyway. So when I was, had just been born, my parents decided they were going to name me Richard Williams. And okay, well, who was Richard Williams different from his dad, from his granddad? And they had a friend who was an actor in Hollywood, not a superstar, but somebody you could find if you looked him up. Anyway, he said, you know, Casablanca with Humphrey Bogart came out, was very popular. And his name was Rick, as in, you know, Rick's Cafe in Casablanca. Why don't you name Richard Rick? And that's what they did. So they called me Rick, as opposed to my dad, who was Dick, and my grandfather, who was Richard. Of course, my mother would call me Ricky. And it wasn't until I was, you know, getting out of high school that I could convince people to stop calling me Ricky. But anyway, but that's how Rick came to be me. And the truth is that, we then become identified with our name as a statement about who we are.
We certainly do. And I feel that way. I think when we embrace our identity and leverage the name, whether our name is Dusty, Rick, or John, we're the only individual in the world who has ever existed with that name and that body of experiences and those parents and that background. So sometimes we can say, well, you know, my name is John Smith and I'm, you know, there's a lot of them out there. There's not, there's only one. There's only one that's like you, and you get to embrace that identity and you get to shift that identity. And I do a lot of thinking about identity and how we get to define that through the decisions we make and the people we surround ourselves with. And our names are just a label for our identity, where we are today and the identity we're becoming.
Well, Dusty, we're having this conversation and you offered to come on the podcast to describe an important decision that you had to make for yourself and for the company you were involved in. Why don't you give us an introduction to that and get us started with a conversation?
Sure thing. I think one of the decisions, and I'll touch on the decision I was talking about a few minutes ago, this decision I made when I was 23 years old to leave a company that I loved and a job I, you know, probably was barely qualified for, but really enjoyed, where I was learning so much and was passionate about the organization. And most importantly, leave a mentor that, you know, frankly, had given me the opportunities to be in this place, in this role that, you know, probably wasn't qualified for, and therefore was setting me up for this next thing. That was a tough decision. And I remember vividly really walking through the process of decision making and how do I turn down this opportunity, which is so incredible. And yet at the same time, honor the person I respect so much and this other tension. And ultimately I decided to take the leap and to embrace this opportunity that was just too good to pass up and have that difficult conversation with my mentor and hopefully do it in a way that conveyed my respect, my appreciation, and my desire to do the right thing.
You know, as I'm listening to you tell your story, I'm actually hearing that there were two decisions that you made. And one was the decision to quit your job and take on, accept the offer to do this other job, which I can imagine was pretty risky. Like, you know, you're really young. Could you really do this? And was failure was a real option? And the other decision you made was to walk into your boss's office with a resignation letter in your hand and talk to him about it. I'd like to kind of separate those two decisions for a second. And let's just start by talking about, how did you go about, as a, I'm not sure how you were old, you were 21, 22, 23 years old, to say, hey, I'm going to quit. I've got a real job here. I'm going to quit it and go take on another job, which I'm not even sure I'm qualified to do. I might be a complete failure at it. But you decided to do that. So let's separate those two decisions out and talk first about how did you go, as a 23-year-old, go about and make that first decision to quit your job and take on this new role that you may not even be qualified for?
Well, I have this first principle belief that when we make decisions, one of the things we have to understand, and anyone who has worked with me over the decades knows that I will ask this question: what is the worst thing that can happen? And so by qualifying and then quantifying the worst possible outcome, I'm enabled to make a risk-based adjusted decision. And, you know, at 23, with, you know, unmarried, no one depending on me, no income stream that would be, you know, irrevocably damaged, the worst thing that can happen is I failed and got fired. Okay, well, if that's the worst that can happen, well, I can always go back and flip burgers and, you know, do the next thing. It'll be fine. You know, that is far outweighed by all the things I could learn. So even if I failed and got fired, I would be learning so much about myself, about this opportunity, and the compound interest that could be paid from the earned from those learnings, which just far outweighed the risk. So that was, you know, kind of risk variable understanding number one. And as far as letting go of the place that I was in, you know, I had to really think through. It's like, what is my career path here? Is it going to advance and give me the opportunities that I'm going to have right now? And then it became a time horizon decision. Like, if I make this decision today, I get a compound learning input factor that I get this experience that will help me when I'm 25, 30, 35, 40. And it may take me until I'm 25 or 30 to get that same degree of experience in this current organization. So even though I love it, and even though I love my mentor, the opportunity to earn a higher compound interest was just so much better.
You know, I as I'm listening to you, this sounds like a very sophisticated understanding of how you make decisions by a 23-year-old. That, you know, one of the things that happens over the course of your career is that you make, most people who are in their early 20s make decisions on a much simpler process or format than they do when they're 35, 40, and 50 years old. And so what comes out in these conversations is that difference. That is one of the differences that comes out in hearing stories like this, that most early 20-year-olds are kind of making pretty simple, using pretty simple criteria for making decisions, whereas somebody who may be 35, 40, or older says, oh, gee, okay, maybe I got to talk to my mentor and my coaches and bring my advisors together and help me make decisions. Were you, contrast in your own experience, were you at the age of your early 20s, did you have counselors, advisors, mentors, or others that you involved with this? Or do you just say, hey, I'm got to figure this out on my own and just make a decision? I mean, what happened when you were in your early 20s, and how would you contrast that with decision-making for yourself when you're older?
Yeah, I certainly had a mentor group, and I've always had and surrounded myself with people whose inputs I value and perspective that is different my own. I think it's so incredibly important for leaders to get divergent thinking that enables you to break free from an echo chamber, or, you know, buying your own cooking, so to speak. And I did. I had conversations with my dad. I had conversations with, you know, other people that I respected, many who were much older than me. So I think that the I was able to grasp accumulated wisdom to inform my decision. Now, I'll be very clear. I wasn't abdicating the decision to someone else. I was still going to make the decision, but I was going to do so with the counsel and perspective of others who could help me see things I couldn't see. You know, I think all the time, and I talk all the time about can't read the label from inside the jar. So, and the only way to do that is to get people that can help you think, and to get people that can help you think more effectively. And I've even, you know, now, you know, almost 30 years later, have had the privilege of, you know, both professional coaching and mentoring relationships, and through forum experiences. I'm a huge fan of forum and being in a mentor groups or peer groups as a way of sharpening your saw. And those principles are what allow you to make a more qualified, more quantifiable, more thoughtful decision, because you've gotten perspective that's not your own, because we can only see the world through our eyes. And I think it's incredibly important to have divergent perspective that doesn't make the decision for you, but informs you, gives you data and information that you need to make a more informed decision, so that you can make a more well-adjusted risk-based decision. And I would say that I follow and employ that same practice today. And maybe I was sophisticated, maybe I wasn't. I was still a 23-year-old kid. You know, my prefrontal cortex wasn't fully formed. But I had the wisdom or the benefit of having been a student of history and how others have made decisions, you know, as a hobby. And I'm sure that that flavored and informed my thinking at the time.
Well, I'm going to ask you to, this is a little bit of a diversion from your decision-making experience, to talk. You mentioned forum. I'm taking, you're a member of a peer support group for your two called Forum, Vistage, other things like that. I'm also a member of a forum group within the Harvard Business School alumni community. And talk a little bit about why that's so important to you.
Yeah, it's incredibly important to me because, well, it's this idea that we have all the information, that, you know, because we think it, we are right. And that is absolutely not the case. And so I've belonged to Vistage for 15 years. I'm a member of YPO today, and I belong to two different forums within my YPO network. And it's this ability to be vulnerable and understand that in order to make the right decisions, I don't have to be right. And I used to really preach, and I don't preach a lot, but I used to preach to my leadership teams, I have zero interest in being right, but I have 100% focus on doing the right thing. So therefore, we need to surface those things that help us make better decisions. We need to surface those things that help us create more authenticity. And the peer network, the forum networks, those are the folks that don't have a stake in the game you're playing, and will call you on your own BS, help you navigate those blind spots, help you see what you can't see. I can think of conversations, you know, very recently, and then going back for years, where people would, you know, they call me out and say, "Hey, Dusty, I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit, or I think you are you've got blind spots right now that aren't being leveraged," and I think that that is. You have to be fundamentally secure with who you are and, you know, where you are to be able to be vulnerable. But when you can do that, what you get is you get the accumulated knowledge and wisdom that others have paid a dearly priced tuition for, that will advance you in your own thinking. And I think about that all the time with my own podcast. The reason I have a podcast is so I can talk to other great leaders and learn from them, and so that our audience can benefit from the accumulated wisdom others have paid for. They've paid the tuition. We might as well learn from it. And so I think that that peer network, that ability to curate inputs that will help you grow, is something that helps, you know, move a person forward exponentially.
You know, I think you are so on target with that. As I say, I belong to a forum group. It's been one of my most valuable life experiences about learning better who I am, what I'm trying to do. and learning from other people's experiences. And often leaders will say, well, I know more about what's going on in this company than anybody else. I mean, why waste my time asking other people what I should be doing when they don't know everything that I know? And in truth, that's not the point. The point is that I will learn from other people talking about their experience in similar situations, because it gives me insight into different ways of looking at my situation that I wouldn't come to on my own. The line of thinking that they have said of how they approached a similar problem for themselves is not telling me what to do. They don't know much about what I'm really facing with. They don't know all the issues I'm facing. But their way of looking at it and their way of thinking about it then gives me a line of thinking that I would not have had without hearing that from them. And I think you're so right that successful leaders are people who are open to learning from the experience of others, not having other people tell them what to do, but learning how to think about approaching a problem. What are different possibilities of a way of thinking about solving a problem? That's what you get from talking with other people. I'm just ask you to do one quick thing on here before we go to your second decision about deciding to talk to your boss with a resignation letter in hand. I am sure that you had some level of fear or apprehension about deciding to quit your job and take on this other job, or anxiety, or it was like, you know, I can do whatever the hell I want to do. I'm all powerful, which is also a characteristic of young people. And you know, didn't think about any of that. I mean, what was your sort of emotional state, and how did you deal with that when making that decision to quit your job? We'll come back and talk about your conversation with your boss, but talk about okay, I'm going to do this. How did you overcome fear, if you were fearful, or you disregard it all and say, hey, God damn it, I knew I can do anything I want to do. I'll just go do it. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I certainly wasn't quite in the I can do anything, but you know, I was nervous, right? You know, this was a big new opportunity, a lot to prove. But I'd spent a lot of my lifetime proving myself and embracing the opportunity to overcome what others said I couldn't do. You know, it's probably why I decided to start doing Ironman racing. It's probably why, you know, I went back and gave my diploma to that college admissions counselor. It's this idea of a challenge that others don't think I can accomplish is rocket fuel for me. And so I was nervous. I was certainly, even then, I was excited. But I was also of the mindset that, okay, I'm going to get this opportunity and I need to make the most of it. How do I need to prepare? You know, learning how to lead yourself and learning how to guide yourself, I think is one of the most fundamentally important lessons that anyone can learn as a leader. And the best way to overcome that thing that gets in your way, or that fear, or that, you know, trepidation is, well, then what must I do? How can I overcome this? How must I prepare? And so I remember being slightly terrified and then incredibly motivated to do the work, to go prepare and do the studying, and not in an ego way, certainly, but in a way of, well, no one's going to outwork me. No one's going to out-hustle me. No one's going to outgrind me. Let me do the work and do the research and, you know, take on the learning and dig in. And that's what I did. And that's what allowed me to say yes to that opportunity and then prepare myself for the conversation with Greg.
So if I was to summarize what you're saying about how you made this a really tough decision, an extremely important decision for you as a 23-year-old, is that you imagine what could go wrong. So you understood what could go wrong. And secondly, you said, what do I have to do to prepare myself to be successful in doing this? Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So what could go wrong? And then what do I have to do? You know, it's what do I need to know? What do I have to do? And let's just go do it. And you know, who are the right people to talk to? What are the right lessons to learn? What are the right resources to pull in? And you know, who do I need to know? One of my favorite statements is, you know, who do you know that I should know? And I love asking people that question. And I remember even then getting, you know, other relationships very quickly so that I could go, hey, I've got this idea, or I've got this challenge. What are your thoughts? What am I missing? You know, one of my favorite leadership questions is when I'm working with teams, whether I'm leading teams or you know, participating in a team, is here's what I'm thinking. Here's what I think I know. What am I missing? What is it that I might be overlooking or neglecting that you could help me see? And, you know, being able to ask for help and doing it in an authentic, vulnerable way, I think is really, really important. And I know I did that then. And I, you know, as I reflect back, you know, sometimes you don't know you're doing these things, or you're not as codified in your thinking. But it is the ability to look back, reflect, learn, and distill and codify into success paradigms that you can then replicate over and over again, which is certainly something I've done with some of the practices I've had and built, like our rules of engagement guide that I work with all my leaders on. And being able to distill these things into the decision principles that allow you to create value. And I've been in forum type of environments for over 20 years. It's an understanding that people will expose thinking that's different than my own and help me think better. I still still reserve the right to make the decision. I'm not going to take anyone else's input as gospel, but it helps me think more clearly. And it's something I recommend to anyone in leadership, is gaining perspective to, you know, make sure that you're really thinking about this. And the way I like to think about things is, this is the scientific method. My hypothesis is this is the good decision. What data do I need that will help me validate or invalidate the hypothesis? And the best way to collect that is from people who think differently than I do.
You know, you are so right on that point. I'm a little bit surprised that you had such a sophisticated understanding of yourself and the you know, what you really should be doing to make decisions at that age. Because usually people don't come to understand and think like that until they're a lot older. And I would be, you know, I'm be speaking for myself and how I was at that age as well. Because I think that one of the fundamental things you learn over life, as you, if you're paying attention at all, is that, you know, whatever it is you are thinking about the right thing to do in any situation, you could be wrong. And that acceptance that you could be wrong requires a certain level of maturity that most people who are in their, you know, early 20s don't have yet. And so if you say, and saying you're wrong doesn't mean self-doubts. It just means, I want to make sure I really understand what the heck I'm doing here. And let me bounce ideas and hear what other people are thinking. That is a level of maturity that takes a little while for people to get to.
Well, I wouldn't say that my prefrontal cortex was fully formed at age 23. I'm still, you know, a typical guy, but I would say that my fundamental upbringing and how I learned and studied and the types of thinking that I studied. I was a huge fan of biographies and military history, and I still am today. I'm reading the biography of Ulysses S. Grant right now. And it just helps understand how people think. And, you know, one of my favorite books of all time is Team of Rivals, about Lincoln's cabinet and the brilliance in assembling a cabinet of differentiated people who actually, in some cases, hated him or hated each other. And, you know, I don't know that I was sophisticated enough to know that I was curating this panel of experts, you know, intentionally, but organically, I certainly was. And then that organic practice certainly has become an intentional practice and now a non-negotiable for myself as I progress through my life. And, you know, it doesn't mean that I'm don't make mistakes, and it doesn't mean that, you know, I don't get good or bad counsel. But I think you said something there that's really important. The decision I make might or might not be the wrong decision. It doesn't mean that I, as a human being, am wrong or that I'm devalued because of the outcome of the decision. And that is something that I have long held as a core operating philosophy, in that the quality of the decisions I make don't have anything to do with my worth or value as a human being. And so like that disassociation has certainly been, you know, a practice. Now, I've lived with a chip on my shoulder ever since somebody told me I was dumb and probably shouldn't be in college. So I've certainly had a lot of things I needed, felt like I needed to prove over my life. And that's manifested, I'm sure, in some very non-beneficial ways. But, you know, I do think that that's a point worth pointing in on, is that you can make bad decisions and still be a great person.
Yeah, no, I think this is worth staying on for just a moment. I have written that in order to be successful as a leader, that you must be both decisive and vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Decisive meaning you're prepared to make decisions. You're prepared to make choices. Not everybody might like the choices you make, but you're prepared to make choices and decisions. But you also will make better decisions if you're vulnerable. And I use that word to cover what we've just been talking about, that acknowledging that, gee, I may not have a full understanding of the realities of the situation at the moment. I may not have a full understanding of the risks that I'm considering undertaking. I may not have a full understanding of, you know, what my real options are. And I'm willing to ask people, ask others, you know, people that I can trust and get good counsel from. I'm willing to ask others what they're thinking and share their experiences. And yes, I, in the end, will make decisions that I have to make, but I am vulnerable in the sense that I'm open to listening and learning from others, and that those two ingredients are essential for being successful in the long term as a leader.
I could not agree with you more. And I think that it's incredibly important to embrace an intentional and authentic practice of vulnerability. It's not vulnerable where you just, you know, expose your feelings, you know, wear your feelings on your shoulder, but it's vulnerable in being able to say, I don't know all of the answers, or, you know, I need counsel here, and not making that aligned with worth. And I think that that's where so many people that I've worked with over the years, and certainly have coached and guided, have really been able to level up their game when they're able to disassociate not knowing with personal worth, and be able to gain the mentors and the experiences that they have to improve. And, you know, I believe, like, is when it comes back down to it, like the ability to create influence on others at a leadership level means that you first must be able to lead yourself. Like, I believe self-leadership is a precedent to any and all other types of leadership at an impact level. And being able to lead yourself means you have to seek clarity and then build alignment. So you have to be clear for yourself what's important. You have to be clear, you know, your own worth and the practices or principles that you believe in. And then you can create alignment. And alignment comes when you are being able to be authentically vulnerable and engage and pull in the inputs of others. And, you know, there's nothing better than saying, hey, I was wrong and I appreciate your counsel, and you exposed to me thinking that I wasn't ready for or didn't understand. I always tell my leadership teams, my job is not to be the smartest guy in the room. If I'm the smartest guy in the room, I've done a piss poor job. My job is to make sure that we have the smartest people in the world in the room at their areas of expertise. My job mm-hmm. is to make sure that we're all aligned and going to the same place, and we understand how we fit into that place, and we understand how we work better together. You know, one of the practices that I'm sure we'll get into, you know, when I work with leadership teams, even now, and I've been doing this for 15 or 20 years, is I, as a leader, would build my own rules of engagement. And that rules of engagement guide is a practice I, again, have given to hundreds of people over the years. It invited vulnerability. In fact, I would tell people, hey, here's what I expect of myself. And when I violate mm-hmm. these principles, I expect you to call me out. And I appreciate it. And so being able to build that dynamic leadership team where they understand where we are going how they contribute to that, and that you as the leader don't have to be the smartest guy in the room, and you can be authentic in that, I think is a understated superpower to make the team better. And it's a nonlinear leadership equation. It's an exponential yeah. leadership equation.
Yeah, I'm going to give you my vocabulary here just a little bit, because it resonates with what you're saying. And that is that I, I say that as a leader, you have a responsibility to make decisions. And often that simple statement is one that a lot of people have difficulty with. Mm-hmm. They want to muddle things through. So to be really clear, as to be a successful leader, you have to be prepared to make decisions, to make mm-hmm. choices. Your other obligation is to manage the process of making decisions. And so you're managing the process of gathering information, creating options, understanding risk, understanding what your goals are. I mean, that is the managing the process. You're also doing what you said, and that is you're managing yourself as a decision maker. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to say, okay, I am going to make a decision. That is my job. That's what I'm getting paid for. But you also want to make sure that the decisions that you're making reflect who you are as a person, your values, the values and goals of your organization, a full understanding of the risk profile that you're willing to accept for yourself, perhaps, or for the organization. I mean, I'm saying what you just said with slightly different words, but I think it captures basically the idea that you're saying.
I agree. And, you know, what I wasn't talking about really was that decision framework and the decision responsibility. And I completely agree with you. In fact, you know, in that my rules of engagement process, one of the elements I ask people to build out is to codify how you make decisions so that when you share that with other people, they know how to show up, because your job, your responsibility is to make decisions. And sometimes it's to ensure decisions get made. You know, I often told right. my leadership teams, you know, I don't have to make all the decisions. In fact, if I do have to make all the decisions, I may not have the right people in the seats. Our job is right. to make decisions as leaders. Here's how I make decisions. You know, if I'm data driven. So if you show up with numbers like, hey, it happened a lot, I'm going to go deep and go, well, how many times is that? Is that 2 out of 4 or is that 2 out of 2,000? Because those are entirely different numbers to me. And so I would communicate to my teams, here is how I make decisions. Here's how you need to be prepared. I will make small decisions very fast. And I'm willing to make decisions with 80% of the information or 50% of the information if the risk variables are low. But if it's a high risk variable, then we're gonna need to go a little deeper. We're gonna be here and very thoughtful about this. But make no bones about it, we're here to create action and outcomes, and that necessitates making decisions. Here's how we actually do it. And I think it's really important to have a codified understanding that, yes, in full agreement with we have to make decisions, and then here's how we do it so that we can create a culture of decision making. And I think that as a leadership success paradigm, when we move from being, you know, people who can create insight and into organizations and people who can activate and really create activation, that's where mm-hmm. the magic happens, right? And we have to do so with the values alignment. We have to do so with expectations mm-hmm. alignment. We have to do it with these other ingredients. But what we are here to do is create outcomes, and that requires decisions.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. That is how you have to approach this. And another way, and maybe I'm kind of passing this on to you for whatever it's worth, is that I also find that starting the conversation or the process, particularly when you're dealing with other people, there may be a committee or executive committee or your leadership team, to start by asking the question, what are the decisions we have to make? Mm-hmm. And it may be we as a group, it may be me, it may be you have to make this decision. What exactly do we have to decide? And I want to say that a lot of people have difficulty making that statement and asking to define the decision that have to be made. Because it's not, whether it should or shouldn't be, I think it should be, it's not natural to the way that most people approach decision making. However, I find that if you start with what exactly do we have to decide here, that is gives you a lot of power as a leader, because it says, I want to define the decisions that we have to make, or I have to make. With those decisions defined, it then allows us, it controls, what do we have to do to make that decision? What information we have to gather? What do we have to do about understanding the risk? As you're saying, is it a big risk or a low risk? It creates a structure for what you do next, leading up to making the specific decisions that you have to make, as opposed to sort of a general discussion about this and that, and without a focus on where are we going? What is the end point of this, which is I or you or the committee is going to make a decision. Start the conversation by getting very specific about what do we have to decide or I have to decide. I think that gives you a lot of power as the leader.
I love that you are pulling this out. And I am full agreement. In fact, I used to tell teams and firmly believe this. There's only three types of meetings that we're ever going to have. Meeting number one is to make decisions. That's why we're here together, so we can surface information and make decisions. Meeting number two is to brainstorm. So when we need to, you know, go get the collective brain function working together and ideate together. And meeting type number three is to communicate. And that's the one that can often be an email instead of an actual meeting. Sometimes you need the vocal or verbal variety to communicate more effectively. But making decisions is like a core thesis. And, you know, my approach it's one of the reasons I love doing podcast interviews is as a guest is I get to learn. I get to hear other people's thinking and go, oh, I like that framing. I like that language. And one of the things I would share with teams is we're here to make decisions. What are the forcing function questions that we need to ask that move us towards that? You know, one of my favorites is what must be true or different to achieve the outcome we want? And that always requires a decision. Mm-hmm. If we can't be different if we haven't made a decision. Now, what's the next best decision we need to make? What is the right? And then it's all the other things that you just went through, which is, you know, what are the resources we need? What are the risks that we have to adjust for? What are the people that we need to involve in this? It's all around identifying what must be different, and that requires a decision.
So, Dusty, I want to go back to your walking into your former boss's office with your letter in hand, your resignation letter in hand. And that I identified that as a separate decision. Mm. Talk about that. I can imagine you were afraid of how he would react. You were hesitant. I said fearful. Talk about your decision to do that and how you felt about it and how you dealt with whatever, your fear, or you said, screw this, I'm going to do it. I don't care what he says. I mean, what was that emotional experience for you?
Yeah, I'm so glad you pulled that out. You know, the overarching emotional experience was I was fearful, and I wasn't afraid physically. I was afraid of letting someone down. And I have had much of my career has been a strength, but it's also, you know, every strength becomes a weakness if over leveraged. You know, this fear of failure, fear of letting someone down, of disappointing another person. And I think that was my overarching emotion. In fact, when you asked the question, that's immediately where I went back to, you know, this 23-year-old kid. You know, I don't want to let someone down. And walking in and knowing that was counterbalanced, which is one of my favorite words, with this respect. Any other way of having that conversation would have been disrespectful to a person that I admired so much. And so while I was afraid of letting this person down and knew that the conversation was not going to be was not one I was looking forward to, I knew it would be fine. But I mean, it's not like I was going to die. But I knew that any other way of handling it, like sliding a letter under the door, was not going to be the right way to do that thing, right? You know, that would have been lacking in courage, to say the least. So I respected the person, and then I prepared for the conversation. And that's one of my core tenets, even, you know, so many years ago, was in an area where I am uncertain as to what's going to happen next, let me prepare. Let me prepare mentally. Let me prepare for the conversation. What's the worst can happen? Blah, blah, blah. But I didn't want to let him down, and I couldn't think of a better way to have that conversation that was, you know, the only way to do it and be aligned with my values.
You know, I think that's great. I think one of the things that people don't take the time to think about is managing their own fears and apprehensions and their hopes and their dreams as part of making a really difficult decision, and kind of managing that part of themselves as part of, you know, as an element that they have to go through when making decisions. Anyway, it's not just, oh, gee, yeah, okay, I've thought about it, now I'm going to make a decision. You need to have enough introspection to say, well, what am I really feeling about this? And is my fear or my hope or controlling what I think I'm about to do? And maybe I should just take a walk and sort of let things settle down or whatever. I just that process of managing yourself is, you know, really an important element of making, when you're making an important decision, managing yourself and putting yourself in the right frame of mind so that in retrospect, you will say, you know, maybe I didn't know everything at the time I could have known, but I made a decision that was a reasonable reflection of my values, of what I was trying to do, my goals, and how I wanted the decision to represent me and the organization that I lead.
Yeah, I think it goes back to this ability to lead yourself first and I think it's harder now than at any point in our own history is to find solitude, to find to give yourself the place to actually think. You know, we live in a world where we're consistently and constantly pinged or, you know, drawn, and we can numb our thinking by through distractions so incredibly easy. And that walk, that place of, you know, of quiet just to think, you know, I think it was probably around that time. I don't know where I learned it. Maybe it was even earlier where I started this idea of, and I think it was Marcus Aurelius or maybe it was Seneca who talked about, you know, surrendering to your subconscious that which is on your mind heavy in the evening. And so like journaling out, hey, this is the thing that's just batting around in my mind. And it's almost like you take this distraction out, you just set it aside, and then you wake up and your subconscious has helped you process that. I think there's so many ways to do it, but you have to actually give yourself the space to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, doom scrolling Instagram is not the same thing as, you know, giving your subconscious the task at hand that you really need to think through. So leading yourself first is the ultimate gift to your future self.
Absolutely. Well, Dusty, this has been an incredible conversation. You've made a great contribution to, I think, everybody's understanding of leadership. And I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. Tell our audience how people get in touch with you if they wanted to do that.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rick. I love this. I could talk this type of stuff for hours. There's two ways. You can find me on LinkedIn. That's certainly the easiest and quickest way. And then if your audience is interested in, you know, I've got this rules of engagement playbook that they can deploy and it helps them codify their thinking. They can simply download that. It's a free gift. It's got an entire playbook. It comes with a personality profile assessment that they can use at myrulesofengagement.com. And it goes back to ability to lead yourself and create with intention the person you want to become and be able to make decisions, to be able to do so vulnerably. And so myrulesofengagement.com, that would get you into our entire ecosystem of thought leadership and information. But most importantly, it'll give a person a proven playbook to make better decisions and create better leadership impact with their lives. And that's ultimately the purpose I think I was put on this earth to do.
Okay, that's great. I want to also thank our audience, those who have tuned in, for grabbing this opportunity to learn from Dusty and his experiences. And if you have an important story that you're open to sharing about making a difficult decision for your organization or for yourself, come on the podcast, apply to be a guest on the podcast. And the way to do that is to go to rickwilliamsleadership.com and then go to the Create the Future podcast section on the website. So again, that's rickwilliamsleadership.com. Remember that you create the future by the decisions you make today. So when you have to make a very important decision for yourself or your company or any organization, Slow down, take time to get it right, and yes, have some fun along the way. So until next time, be well. What an interesting and inspiring conversation. I hope you found it as valuable as I did. Thank you for listening. Let me know if you have a compelling story to tell about making tough choices for your organization or for yourself. Coming on my podcast is a way to share what you have learned with a wider audience. If someone you know would be a great guest, please make an introduction. I welcome leaders with a story to tell and important learning to share. You can contact me about the podcast at podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. That's podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. Please share the link to my podcast with your colleagues. They will thank you for getting them access to these valuable conversations. And finally, please give us a great rating on and subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Just search for Create the Future with Rick Williams. Thank you for listening to Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast. Conversation with leaders who make difficult decisions and build lasting legacies.